Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're diving into a case you sent us, Whitman v. American Trucking Associations.
Oh, yeah.
This one's all about the EPA
okay.
and their power to set those air quality standards, you know, the National Ambient Air Quality Standards.
Yeah.
Or NAQS.
NAQS.
For short. You sent over a whole stack of briefs and opinions, so
yeah.
we'll be looking at the Clean Air Act, constitutional law.
Okay.
And even some regulatory philosophy.
This case is a really important one. It kind of sets some boundaries for the EPA.
Right.
And it also brings up some interesting questions about how we balance, you know, public health
yeah.
with economic concerns when we're thinking about environmental regulation.
Okay, so let's start with the basics. I think most people know the EPA is supposed to protect the environment.
Sure.
But what exactly are these NAQS
mm-hmm.
and what role do they play in the Clean Air Act?
So think of the Clean Air Act as the rule book for clean air in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
And NAQS are like specific chapters that set limits on certain pollutants,
mm-hmm.
things like ozone and particulate matter.
Right.
They're designed to protect public health. Basically, they say this is the maximum level of this pollutant that's considered safe to breathe.
So these NAQS are all about protecting public health, not about the economics.
Right.
Got it. So where does the Whitman case fit into all this?
So back in 1997, the EPA decided to update the NAQS for ozone and particulate matter, making them stricter.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, did not make some industries very happy,
right.
including the American Trucking Associations.
Okay.
They, along with several states,
yeah.
challenged these new standards. Mm-hmm. And the case ultimately ended up at the Supreme Court.
So it's a classic battle, public health versus the economics.
Exactly.
What were the main arguments the trucking associations and states used against the EPA?
There were three big issues.
Okay.
First, can the EPA consider the cost to industries to comply with the NAQS when setting those standards?
Right.
Second, does giving the EPA the power to set these standards mean we've given them too much power,
uh-huh.
essentially letting them act like Congress?
Gotcha.
And then finally, there's a technical question about which specific section of the Clean Air Act should be used to implement the revised ozone standards.
So we've got a cost issue, a constitutional power struggle.
Yes.
And a bit of a legal puzzle.
Oh.
Sounds like we've got our work cut out for us.
Yeah.
Let's start with that first issue, the cost of compliance.
Okay.
Can the EPA factor that in when setting air quality standards?
This is where things get really interesting.
Okay.
The Supreme Court, in a majority opinion written by Justice Scalia,
mm-hmm.
said no, absolutely not.
Wow.
The Clean Air Act, according to the court, is crystal clear. The EPA can't even consider
okay.
costs when setting these standards.
Wow. That's a pretty strong stance.
It is.
So the court's saying clean air is more important than economic concerns,
right.
at least when setting those initial standards. But the EPA must have some reason for wanting to consider costs, right? What was their argument?
So the EPA argued that protecting public health includes considering the economic impacts of regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Their logic was that if regulations are so strict that they cripple industries,
yeah.
it could indirectly harm public health through job losses and economic hardship.
That makes sense, actually. If people can't afford health care or their basic needs because environmental regulations have tanked the economy, it's kind of a meaningless victory for
yeah.
clean air.
It's a complicated issue, but the court wasn't swayed.
Okay.
They pointed to the specific language of the Clean Air Act, which, as Justice Scalia put it, unambiguously bars the EPA from considering costs.
Round one goes to clean air advocates.
Yes.
But I see Justice Breyer, who often a little more pragmatic about this stuff, wrote a concurring opinion.
He did.
What was his take on the cost issue?
Justice Breyer agreed with the outcome.
Okay.
But he emphasized a different aspect of the Clean Air Act. He pointed out that Congress designed the act to be what he called technology forcing.
Okay.
Meaning it deliberately sets ambitious standards,
right.
even if the technology to easily meet them doesn't exist yet.
So Congress is saying, we're setting the bar high.
Exactly.
To push industries to innovate and create those cleaner solutions.
That's right.
That's a bold move.
It is. It assumes that industries will rise to the occasion and figure out how to meet those standards, even if it's costly in the short term.
So we've got two different perspectives
yes.
on why the EPA can't consider cost.
Right.
One based on the actual words of the law, and one based on this idea of pushing for technological innovation.
Right.
Interesting. But what about that second big issue, this whole question of whether the Clean Air Act gives the EPA too much power.
Yeah, the constitutional power struggle.
Right.
This is where we get into some legal weeds.
Okay.
So the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals initially said that a specific part of the Clean Air Act, Section 109(b)(1), might be unconstitutional because it gave the EPA too much power.
Right.
Basically letting them create laws instead of just enforcing them.
Hold on. So the lower court is saying that Congress might have given away too much of its authority to the EPA.
That's exactly right.
That's a serious accusation. What did the Supreme Court have to say about that?
The Supreme Court disagreed with the lower court and said that the Clean Air Act doesn't cross that constitutional line.
Okay.
They used what's called the intelligible principle test.
Okay.
Basically, this means Congress can't just give the EPA a blank check and say, go regulate the environment however you want.
Yeah.
The law has to provide specific guidelines and limits on the EPA's authority.
So there have to be some rules of the road.
Exact.
And did the Supreme Court feel like the Clean Air Act provided those rules?
They did. They pointed to the requirement in the Clean Air Act that the EPA must protect public health with an adequate margin of safety. The court found that this language gave the EPA enough guidance to act without overstepping its bounds.
So protect public health with an adequate margin of safety is specific enough.
Yeah.
Go make the air clean would be too vague.
Exactly.
It's all in the wording.
It is.
But hold on. I see that Justice Taz also wrote a concurring opinion on this issue.
Yeah, he did.
Is he on board with this intelligible principle test?
So he agreed with the outcome in Whitman, saying there wasn't an unconstitutional delegation of power in this specific case.
Okay.
But he did express some concerns that this intelligible principle test may not always be enough to prevent Congress from giving away too much of its power to agencies.
So he's leaving the door open for future challenges to this kind of broad delegation of power.
He is.
Interesting. And to make things even more interesting, it looks like Justice Stevens also chimed in with his own concurring opinion.
Yeah.
What was his perspective?
Justice Stevens actually argued that the power given to the EPA to set these air quality standards is actually legislative in nature.
Okay.
Meaning it's the kind of power that normally belongs to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
But he still felt it was constitutional because the Clean Air Act puts enough limits on how the EPA can use that power.
So we've got three different justices.
We do.
Three slightly different views on the whole delegation of power issue.
Yes.
But ultimately, they all agree that the Clean Air Act, as written, doesn't violate the Constitution.
That's right.
Good to know. But we're not quite done yet, are we? There's still that third issue about the specific rules for implementing these revised ozone standards.
That's right. And that's where we get into the nitty-gritty of Subpart 1 versus Subpart 2 of the Clean Air Act.
Okay.
Which gets a little technical.
Well, I'm all ears. This case is like a legal thriller.
Yeah.
Lead the way.
So the Clean Air Act has these different sections called subparts that lay out specific rules for dealing with areas that aren't meeting those NAVIA AQS.
Right.
These are called non-attainment areas. Mm-hmm. And the big question in Whitman was which subpart should control how those revised ozone standards would be implemented in those non-attainment areas.
So we've got different sets of rules, and we need to figure out which set applies to these new ozone standards.
Exactly.
What did the EPA say?
They argued that subpart one, which lays out the general rules for all non-attainment areas, should apply.
Okay.
They said that subpart two, which deals specifically with ozone, was outdated and didn't make sense with the revised standards.
So it sounds like the EPA tried to bypass those ozone-specific rules in favor of the more general rules.
Yeah, it does.
I wonder why. Was it just to make things easier for themselves?
It seems that way.
Okay.
It looks like they wanted more flexibility in implementing the new ozone standards.
Okay.
And subpart two, with all of its specific requirements and deadlines, felt a bit too restrictive.
Less red tape, more wiggle room.
Yeah.
But did the court buy that argument? Did they let the EPA just ignore subpart two?
Not a chance.
Oh.
The Supreme Court found the EPA's interpretation unreasonable.
Okay.
They basically said that the EPA can't just ignore large chunks of subpart two that were still clearly relevant, even if those rules didn't perfectly align with the EPA's preferred approach.
So no picking and choosing which rules they like.
Correct.
Sounds like a bit of a scolding from the EPA. What happened next?
It does.
Did they have to completely start over with implementing the new ozone standards?
Not exactly. The court didn't tell the EPA how to implement the standards.
Okay.
They sent the issue back to the EPA and said, you need to come up with a more reasonable interpretation of these rules that respects what Congress intended when they wrote the Clean Air Act.
Back to the drawing board.
Yes.
So I've got a clear answer on the cost issue, but things are a lot murkier when it comes to these implementation rules.
Uh-huh.
This is what makes environmental law so fascinating and complicated.
It is, absolutely.
This has been quite a journey through the legal landscape. Before we wrap up part one,
yes.
Any final thoughts for our listener on Whitman and what we've learned so far?
One key takeaway for you is that the EPA has a very strong mandate to protect public health.
Okay.
But they have to operate within the boundaries set by Congress. They can't just pick and choose which parts of the law they want to enforce.
It's a balancing act. The EPA has a big job to do.
It is.
But they have to color inside the lines.
Yes.
We'll dig deeper into the implications of all this and what happens next for the EPA in part two of this deep dive. Stay tuned.
All right. Welcome back to the deep dive. We've been unraveling a truly fascinating Supreme Court case, Whitman v. American Trucking Associations, focusing on the EPA's power to set those all-important air quality standards.
We've uncovered some interesting insights about how the court balances the EPA's authority with economic considerations and the limits set by the Constitution.
And we left off on a bit of a cliffhanger, exploring that legal tug of war between subpart one and subpart two of the Clean Air Act.
Okay.
You know, those sections dealing with how to implement the ozone standards in areas that are struggling to meet the NAAQS.
Right. The court basically told the EPA they couldn't just sidestep those ozone-specific rules in subpart two just because they seemed a bit inconvenient. It's like the EPA tried to order a pizza, but then argued with the delivery driver about what route to take.
That's a great analogy. The court essentially said, you can't ignore the rules just because you don't like them. Go back and figure out how to implement these standards in a way that makes sense.
So what exactly was it about the EPA's interpretation of these subparts that the court found so unreasonable?
Well, one of the key issues was that subpart two has this very detailed table that classifies areas based on how bad their ozone levels are and sets specific deadlines for them to clean up their act. And the EPA basically tried to just ignore this whole system, which the court found unacceptable.
So it's not just about tweaking a few deadlines.
Yeah.
The EPA was trying to rewrite the whole game plan for dealing with ozone pollution. No wonder the court pushed back.
Exactly. The court emphasized that Congress put a lot of thought into those ozone-specific rules, and the EPA has to respect that legislative intent. They can't just substitute their own judgment for what Congress clearly laid out in the law.
So it sounds like the EPA was trying to hit the fast-forward button on cleaning up ozone.
Yes.
But the court said, not so fast. Congress set a specific timeline, and you need to stick to it.
That's a good way to put it. The court also pointed out that subpart two includes provisions that were designed to be phased in gradually over time.
Good.
Some of those rules weren't even supposed to take effect until years after the Clean Air Act was passed.
Oh, so Congress had a long-term vision.
They did.
For tackling ozone pollution.
Yes.
But the EPA was trying to jump ahead.
Yes. And to make things even more absurd, the court pointed out that under the EPA's interpretation, some areas would have been forced to meet the new, stricter ozone standards under subpart one, in the same time frame they were originally given under subpart two to meet the old, less strict standards.
That's like telling someone they have to run a marathon and at the same time they were given to walk a mile. It just doesn't make sense.
You're exactly right. It was completely illogical, and the court called them out on it. They basically said, look, we understand that there might be some gaps or inconsistencies in subpart two, but that doesn't mean you can just ignore the whole thing. You need to go back and find a way to apply these rules in a way that's reasonable and consistent with what Congress intended.
So a victory for legal consistency.
Yes.
But maybe a bit of a headache for the EPA as they try to figure out how to navigate those complex rules.
Mm.
What does all this mean for the rest of us breathing this air? What's the real world impact of the Whitman decision on air quality regulations going forward?
That's the million-dollar question.
Right.
Whitman is a very important precedent because it sets some clear boundaries on the EPA's authority.
Okay.
While at the same time affirming their core mission to protect public health. It's like the court is saying, you have a big job to do, EPA, but you got to color inside the lines.
And those lines are drawn by Congress.
Exactly.
Not the EPA.
Exactly.
One of the big takeaways from Whitman is that the EPA can't just pick and choose which parts of the Clean Air Act they want to enforce. They have to work within the framework Congress created.
Exactly. Whitman is a win for those who believe in clear and consistent regulations, but it also leaves us with some unanswered questions.
Okay.
You know, it doesn't lay out a perfect roadmap for how the EPA should deal with complex situations, like this ozone issue where different parts of the law seem to be in tension with each other.
So it clarifies some things, but also opens up some new avenues.
It does.
So debate and interpretation. Classic Supreme Court.
Exactly.
This case really makes you think, how far should the government go to protect the environment? Is there a point where those regulations become so burdensome that they actually do more harm than good?
That's a great question, and it's something that Justice Breyer's concurring opinion touches on. Remember, he highlighted the fact that the Clean Air Act was designed to be technology forcing, pushing industries to develop cleaner solutions even if they're not readily available yet.
Right.
But, you know, that might be a little idealistic.
Yeah.
Can we really just innovate our way out of every environmental problem? And what about the costs of that innovation? Who bears those costs?
Right.
What are the economic and social implications?
Wow, you've just opened up a whole new can of worms.
Yeah.
Whitman highlights this ongoing tension between protecting public health and considering the practical realities of implementation.
It does.
It's a balancing act that we're going to continue grappling with as we face the challenges of air pollution and climate change. This deep dive has been eye-opening. Before we wrap up part two, any final thoughts to leave our listeners with?
I think one of the most fascinating things about this case is that it doesn't give us all the answers. You know, it leaves us with some important questions to ponder. For you, the big takeaway is that even when the EPA is trying to do the right thing and protect public health, they have to operate within a complex legal framework. And sometimes those laws create unintended consequences or lead to situations where different goals like clean air and economic growth seem to be at odds with each other. It's a reminder that environmental regulation is a process, not a destination.
It's a great point. There's no easy fix.
Nope.
No magic bullet. It's a process of ongoing debate, compromise, and adaptation. We'll continue exploring these themes and what happens next in the saga of the EPA and the Clean Air Act in part three of this deep dive. Don't miss it. Welcome back to the deep dive.
Yeah.
We've spent the last two parts really digging deep into Whitman v. American Trucking Associations, a case that's really all about the EPA's power under the Clean Air Act.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey, hasn't it?
It has. Uncovering those legal arguments, exploring those different judicial perspectives, and even untangling some of those tricky implementation rules.
Yeah, for sure. And
we saw that the court gave a clear victory to the clean air advocates when it comes to those cost considerations.
Yeah.
The EPA can't factor in those economic impacts when setting those initial air quality standards.
Right.
But we've also uncovered some lingering questions about how the EPA can effectively implement those standards within the framework Congress has created.
Exactly.
You left us with a really thought-provoking question at the end of part two. If the EPA can't even consider costs when setting those initial standards, how do we make sure that the regulations actually strike a balance?
Yeah, how do we
between
do that?
Protecting public health and avoiding those overly burdensome economic impacts?
That's the dilemma, isn't it? On one hand, we want clean air and a healthy environment.
Right.
But on the other hand, we don't want regulations that cripple industries and lead to economic hardship.
Exactly. And it seems like Whitman doesn't offer a simple solution.
No, it doesn't.
It clarifies some things.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But it really highlights how complex this issue is.
It really does. It's one of the things that makes this case so fascinating. It's not just a legal puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, it's a reflection of a much broader societal debate about how we balance, you know, these competing priorities.
It seems like this tension between environmental protection and economic growth is something we're going to be grappling with for a long time.
I think so. And I think Whitman shows us there aren't any easy answers.
Right.
But it also gives us some valuable insights that can help us navigate this very complex terrain.
So what are some of those key takeaways for our listeners? What can we learn from Whitman as we think about the future of air quality regulation?
Well, I think one of the most important lessons is that clarity is really paramount.
Okay.
Congress needs to give agencies like the EPA clear guidance.
Okay.
And the EPA, in turn, needs to interpret and implement those laws in a way that is consistent and predictable.
No more sneaking around subpart two.
Right, exactly.
But beyond that legal clarity, it seems like Whitman also highlights the need for that ongoing dialogue
Absolutely.
Between those regulators, the industry, and the public.
It's really important. Finding that sweet spot between protecting public health and fostering that economic growth requires, you know, a collaborative approach. We need open communication, a willingness to consider different perspectives, and a commitment to finding solutions that work for everyone.
So Whitman might not have all the answers, but it at least points us in the right direction.
Right.
And it reminds us that environmental regulation is an ongoing process. It's not a one-and-done thing. And it underscores the importance of finding ways to balance those competing interests in a way that really benefits both our planet and our economy.
It is a challenge for sure, but it's one that we can't ignore. And cases like Whitman can really help us think more critically and strategically about how we approach these really complex issues.
This has been a really illuminating deep dive. Thanks for guiding us through the legal intricacies.
Of course, it's been a pleasure.
And broader implications of Whitman v. American Trucking Associations. I really feel like I have a much deeper understanding of the Clean Air Act and the challenges of environmental regulation in general.
I'm glad to hear that. And for you listening out there, you know, keep asking those tough questions, stay engaged in the conversation, and remember that we all have a role to play in protecting our environment and creating a sustainable future for everyone.
That's it for this deep dive. See you next time.